known Patty for quite a few years, and she has given so much to this program of Alcoholics Anonymous, from the group level to the district level to the state level. And we're truly lucky to have her as a speaker tonight. So, Patty.
I have my own little microphone. Buddy said I could walk around the room if I wanted to. I'm Patty, I'm an alcoholic. I am very happy to be here. My sobriety date is July 4th, 1986. I'm an active member of the Homewood Group in Albany, Georgia. And I say active member because I think there's two kind of group members. One is inactive and one is active. And what I have seen in my time here is the active members are the winners, so I choose to be an active member. Today was wonderful. Thank you, Dick and Jerry. I was sitting there all day kind of trying to take in all that information, probably got maybe a third of it, and thinking, wow, I should say that tonight. Wow, I should say that. And, you know, stuff that I know I've read before, but just it didn't jump out at me, and I've forgotten all of it. I don't quote stuff well, but it was so good to be sitting here. And last night I went to a group here, a step study, and I moved from Lawrenceville just almost a year ago, and my home group was a step study. Since I have been in Albany, I have not been to a step study or a big book study. And last night actually, I thought, God, I missed this. What a gap in my sobriety or my program of recovery. And if you don't go to one on a regular basis, you really should. I didn't even know how much I was missing until I was sitting in that meeting last night and then sitting here today and just getting filled up with AA stuff. And I brought three women with me from Albany, and we've decided we're going to start a big book study. There's not one that I can go to, so we're going to start one. And because it has always been a part of my sobriety, and it has added so much, and I've missed it, and I didn't even realize that. That was the prize I got from being here today, is I need more of this, and I wasn't aware that I was missing it. I'm going to tell you what it was like for me, what happened, and what it's like today. I grew up in Maryland. I was actually born in Pennsylvania, but grew up in Maryland. And I'm one of six children. Family life was not great, but not really that bad. You know, the older I get, the less I think it was, that bad. I think when I was a teenager and getting sober, I thought it was horrible. But I had a very sick mother, and my parents were divorced. I had that kind of not normal family, but all of my physical needs were met. I was not physically abused. I probably was neglected. I had a home and I had clothes and I went to school every day and had food. And that's a lot better than some people have it. So, my mother had six children and I have two of my own. And I just don't know how she managed that, quite honestly. And I have a lot more respect for her today than I did when I was living in that house. growing up, I was very shy, and still am. And so painfully shy, where I would just physically remove myself from situations that I was uncomfortable in. I would hide behind my sisters, I would hide behind my mother, and I have three sisters that love to take care of me, so they would help me with that, and if anyone spoke to me, they would answer. Whichever one was closest would answer for me so I didn't have to. And then the attention would immediately shift to the person talking and I could quietly slip away. And they did that for me for a long time. As a matter of fact, they'll still do that for me if I let them. But now I'm more apt to open my mouth and answer for myself, which you taught me here, by the way. So I kind of went through life like that, hiding behind them, just not trying not to rock the boat, didn't want any attention. And even in my family, not you know, outside the family, yes, but even sitting at the dinner table, I didn't want any attention. And I grew up in a home where we had dinner every night together. And in school, I was very, very quiet, didn't really participate, got good grades, but as long as I didn't have to talk, I could do anything but talk. And when my father left, I was 10. My older brothers and sisters were teenagers, and my mother, as I said, was very sick. I think depressed. I'm not real sure what was wrong because she really didn't get any treatment. But she kind of stopped parenting us when he left, in the sense of setting guidelines, setting rules, that sort of thing. And so my older brothers and sisters started having parties at our house all the time with their friends. And there was a lot of beer, a lot of loud cars, loud music, and it appeared to me as a lot of fun. And I don't know what else was happening. That's all I saw in the house. They came and went a lot, so there may have been other things happening too, but that's what I saw. And it really just seemed like a lot of fun to me. And, you know, I remember thinking, if I drank, I could do that too. I could laugh and I could have fun and talk to people. And I watched that for a while. And then I decided that I wanted to get drunk. And, you know, I didn't want to drink. I wanted to get drunk. My family is, everybody in my family drinks except me and my younger brother now, and who just celebrated 10 years. And we grew up in a house where you had cold duck on New Year's Eve and Irish whiskey when you were sick and cream de menthe on ice cream. But my parents didn't get drunk. They just drank. My mother drank a couple times a year. My father drank casually. And so I didn't really pay attention to that because people, when we were doing that, it wasn't changing anybody's personality. They were just having a drink. That didn't seem like a big deal. But then when these teenagers were partying my house, their personalities were changing. They were getting drunk. And that was real attractive to me. So me and a couple of my girlfriends put our money together and we got a bottle of Mad Dog 2020. And boy, I got drunk. That'll do it. That will do it. And I loved that stuff. And that night, I got drunk, blacked out, threw up, and I guess passed out. And I thought it was great. Because I was able to experience that fun and just laughing and carrying on that I saw. And that's what I wanted to do. I could not do that on my own. And I felt a part of the group that I was with. I guess I was 12 or 13. I'm not really sure. But that's the way I drank. That's the way I like to drink. And at that point, I would drink whenever I could, which was probably weekends. I don't really remember, but I would assume it was probably weekends. And we, you know, it was the same thing. All the girlfriends would put their money together, and we would buy either Mad Dog 2020 or these little bottles of wine that came in six packs, and I don't remember what they were called. And I would get my share. I would have already calculated based on how much money I put in, how much was mine. And I would get it and sit it beside me. I wouldn't put it in the refrigerator or, you know, anywhere in ice. I wanted it right beside me to make sure I got all mine. And if there was any left of yours, I was going to have that too. And we had one of our neighbor's friends, her parents let us drink in their house. And so we would always sit in their garage and drink. And they would actually go buy it for us. So that's the way we drank. And, you know, I had this friend. My best friend was Dawn, and she was very nice, and she was from a very nice family. Her father was an air traffic controller. Her mother was a housewife, and they were just this perfect little family until I came over there. And, you know, I don't know why her parents always let me spend the night, because they had to have known we were drinking. I was always either passed out in their front yard or throwing up in their bathroom. And, you know, when that happens, you can't not know it's happening, you know, if you're in the house. And they never, ever said that I couldn't spend the night. And I just, you know, I wonder now why they let me. I assume they must have felt sorry for me. But, you know, I just, at the time, I didn't know just what that must have looked like. And you know, what they thought about their daughter hanging out with me. And she wasn't throwing up. She drank, but I guess not as much as me. I don't really know. I was always the one laying on the ground in the front yard and having to be dragged into the house. And they let me come over there. And, you know, as I continued to drink like that, my friends kept changing because, you know, you get tired of that. And I started to experiment with drugs. I used every kind, and I abused every kind. And I still did well at school. I just didn't go as much. And I was living in a home where there wasn't any consequences for not going. And I didn't have a curfew. I went in when everybody else went in. I never had a curfew. And so I pretty much kind of felt like I could do whatever I wanted. You know, my mother would have probably disagreed with that if you'd asked her, but there just didn't seem to any consequences to me staying out late or staying out all night or not going to school. And when I was about 13, I decided, and I don't know what happened, I just remember acting as if I had made this decision, that I was the only person I could count on because I could not trust anybody else to look out for my best interest, and that I was going to depend on me, and that was it. And that's the way I lived until I got sober and learned how to rely on a higher power. When I was 16, I got pregnant. I had fallen in love with my son's father, and he was actually my second boyfriend. My first boyfriend was only my boyfriend because he wanted to be, and I didn't know how to say no. My second boyfriend, I actually liked. I fell in love with him, and I got pregnant. And two things happened there. First, before I got pregnant, I knew already, I think I was 15 when I started dating him. I knew at 15 that when I drank too much, and that I was going to be sloppy drunk, blacked out, and sick. So, of course, I didn't want to make that kind of impression on the guy that I was in love with, so I didn't drink that much with him. And I got pregnant and decided to have a baby, because I'm making the decisions for my life, right? So I'm going to have a baby. I moved out and moved in with this guy who was a drug dealer and a high school dropout, and I was going to be pregnant and keep going to high school, and we were going to live happily ever after. and I guess we did for a short time. Anyway, I had my son. I did not drink while I was pregnant. I didn't use drugs while I was pregnant. I did early on, but then stopped. And after I had my son, we were living together. We stayed together another year, and then I decided that I didn't want to live like this. I wasn't going to bring my son up in this kind of lifestyle, you know, with the drug dealer and all the kinds of people that were coming over to our house. And when I made that decision, I started drinking just the way I had been drinking, as much as I could, as much as I could hold. And we hadn't actually broke up yet, but I had already made the decision we were, and I didn't care anymore. And I started going out and staying out all night and getting drunk and not knowing where I was, not knowing how I got home. And then we actually split up, and I was 18 years old, did not have a driver's license, and had a part-time job, and I now had a two-year-old son. And I was making the decisions for myself, and that's, you know, what I was going to do. And I was drinking heavily again. And I was somehow able to kind of pull it together, got a driver's license, got a car, got a second part-time job instead of a full-time job, but, you know, was able to kind of pull it together. Moved in and out of my mother's house several times. Live with friends, and drank a lot. And I was working at a sub shop, and on top of that sub shop was bartending school. And I knew the owner because he came down and ate lunch in our sub shop, and I went, somehow convinced him to teach me how to be a bartender and get me a job, and he did. and I don't know how that worked out because I was 19, and I'm not sure if, I think you were supposed to be 21. But anyway, it worked out. And it was a little family-owned bar in East Baltimore and in a Polish neighborhood. And that may be how it worked out. They just didn't, they needed cheap labor. and I was it. and I got that job, and I was so happy with myself. I thought, I have arrived. This is a good job. I'm going to make good money, and I can drink all night long. And by the way, I now work nights, and my babysitter was so kind. She would say, oh, don't pick Billy up at 2 in the morning. You just come get him when you get up in the morning. Well, you know, that meant when I was finished partying in the morning, not when I got up. And I worked at that bar, I don't know, 6 or 9 months or something. But, you know, now I'm a bartender. So it didn't matter how long I worked there. I've had a bartending job, and that's what I'm going to do now. And anyway, for the next 6 years, my life was, that was it. I was working nights. I was working in restaurants and bars, and I stayed out all night. I drank all night. And my son spent most of his time with babysitters because I was drinking and working. And when we were home, I was asleep on the couch because I had been up for 3 or 4 days, and he was in front of the television eating cereal. And that's kind of the way we lived. You know, even knowing at 15 that I drank the way I drank, it never occurred to me that I shouldn't drink. And I'm not sure it even occurred to me when I ended up in treatment that I shouldn't drink. Until I learned about alcoholism. That's when I learned that I shouldn't drink. I didn't know. For some reason, I just never put the drinking and the trouble and all of this stuff together. But I did know that I drank too much. And I would do things like drink wine before I went out so maybe I wouldn't drink as much tequila. Or I would change to whiskey because I really didn't like the way that tasted. But, you know, after 2 or 3, you don't really taste it anyway. And so that didn't help. So I would do little things like that, just trying to control how drunk I got. Not that I didn't want to get drunk, I just didn't want to get that drunk. And it, you know, of course it didn't work. And I would do that after nights when I would lose my car in Baltimore City, or I went to this nightclub in Baltimore and the parking garage was in a, or the parking was in a, it was like a parking deck with all these cement walls, and I would run into those walls all the time. All the time, I drove right into the walls. I think they were like halfway down. Laura's laughing because she says I drive like a maniac. But they were like this high. I guess I didn't see them, but I had this car that was smashed on the front and the back. I mean, just smashed. And that car ended up in my mother's backyard on blocks with all the tires off, the engine out of it, the sunroof was shattered, it was smashed in the front and the back, and it got repossessed. And they had to take it away in 2 trips, and it was just a Pontiac Sunbird. I mean, it should have, you know, fit right on that flatbed. But it was in such a mess. You know, and after things like that would happen, then I'd try to control how drunk I got, but it never occurred to me not to drink. It just, I never really thought of that. And I moved every 6 months. You know, I tried to sit down and figure it out. And I got sober when I was 23. So over like a period of 6 years maybe, I moved 10 times and I lived one place for a year. So, and the reason I moved so much is because I couldn't pay my bills. And it would take about 6 months to get evicted. And I would leave right before I got evicted, and because I would pay the rent once or twice. And I'm not real sure what happened to me, but I was living in a friend of mine's garage, and I lived in garages, I lived in my car, I lived in a campground. Those weren't in the 10 moves; those were interim living spots. And I was living in my friend's garage, and I had like about a week where on and off I could not function. My arms and legs were numb, like they were asleep. I couldn't think. I couldn't make a decision. I couldn't get myself dressed. Kept having to take a hot bath to get feeling back in my arms, and I didn't really know what was going on, and of course I didn't go to a doctor, but I just kind of kept trying to deal with it, and I'd go to work, and then I, after about the end of a week, I couldn't even go to work. And anyway, I ended up, somehow I was in my friend's house in her bedroom, and I guess I was trying to call somebody, and I was laying on the floor, and she came in and found me, and she called my family and said, "You need to come get her, she needs help." And you know, my family, and as I said, they all drink, and I'm not sure if any of them are alcoholics, but they all drink daily, pretty much. And so I think it was really hard for them to think that I had a drinking problem, just because they drank all the time. They didn't have a problem. Why would I? You know, they thought that I had a drug problem, and if I just didn't do that, that I would be okay. And so they took me away and started to treat me for that. And they took my, one sister took my son, the other sister took me, and I think I was there about a month and a half, and they, you know, it's funny when I look back, I don't feel like I participated in what was going on. I feel like they did things to me and for me. I don't know that I participated, but they took me out and got me some decent clothes so they could take me on interviews for a decent job, like an office job or something. And they took me to drug counseling, and they gave me wine every night with dinner. And my my father is I was living in my sister was living in Baltimore near him, and that's where I was, and with her, and we would have dinner at his house quite often, and he would have a bottle of wine on the dinner table, and I would just help myself and keep refilling my glass. And I think it was probably the third night I was over there, he started putting the bottle behind him on the buffet and not on the table, so that I couldn't drink the whole bottle. And, you know, so I stayed there for about a month and a half. And you know what? I didn't get better because they didn't take the alcohol away from me, and there wasn't any recovery there for me. And after about a month and a half, I used my son as a reason to leave. And I basically said, "I want him back, and if you're not going to bring him back, I'm leaving." The truth was, I wanted to go back to living the way I was living. And so I went and got him and moved in on somebody's couch, and resumed my life right where I left it. And, you know, that was kind of my first, the first help I ever got, and I didn't really ask, it was just kind of there. But the counselor I went to did talk to me about meetings, and I assume she was talking about NA meetings. I don't really know, because I wouldn't go. But she was, I think, at least trying to tell me that maybe there was some kind of problem there. And I just, I didn't hear her. I don't really know what she said to me, except that she kept talking about I should go to these meetings. I did walk to one of them once and looked in the window and left. I didn't go in. It was kind of on a... there was a window front on the street, and I looked in and thought, I'm not going. And but that was kind of the first time, and I really thought nothing about it, left, went on with my life, and picked up right where I left off. And, you know, probably about another year later, again, I got myself into a place where I didn't have a job, and I was unemployable. I got a job bartending at this bar, and they fired me the second day because I couldn't function. And I was living in an apartment. I had no gas and electric, and I would steal electric from the apartment complex. I put an extension cord out the window and plugged it into the outside plug, and had a cooler for milk, and drank every day. And I could buy a pint of vodka and a half pint of Kahlua, but I couldn't pay a gas and electric bill. And I, you know, I lived like that for, I think, 3 months. And I finally got a job, and I remember when I finally got the job, every day on my, or every night on my way home from work, I would stop and buy candles, extension cords, and ice. And the extension cords were because the maintenance people cut my extension cords every morning because I was stealing their electric. And, the candles were for light because they cut my extension cords, and then, of course, ice for the milk. And And the pint of vodka and half pint of Kahlua. And and I thought I was doing good. I thought I was doing good because I was going home after work. And that was being good. It didn't matter that I was picking up the alcohol on the way home. And, my life was like that. And I had this little boy who was just exposed to so much and so many people coming and going. And, you know, when someone would knock on the door, he knew what that meant. He knew that meant somebody was coming in, mommy was going to be distracted. I don't know what he thought, but he would stand in front of the door and hold his arms out like this to try to block me from answering the door. And he was in kindergarten, and when he started kindergarten, we lived in an apartment in a house, and he would the bus would pick him up and take him to school and then drop him off. And of course, he'd leave in the morning, and I'd leave and go out and do whatever it was I did, and I couldn't get home on time. And the bus, thank God for bus drivers and school teachers that know which kids need special attention, because they would drop him off and come around and see if I was home and pick him back up if I wasn't. And that happened a lot, more than I care to even recall. And I can't tell you how many times I had to rush to that school when I got home and realized I had missed the bus, and there he was sitting in the office. I knew that was wrong. I knew it was bad. I couldn't do it differently. And I felt like shit, but I could not do it differently. So I drank more. I drank more because that's all I knew how to handle it. That's how I knew how to handle it. And he was in car accidents with me while I was drinking. At one particular accident we had, I'm not real sure what happened. I don't know if I passed out or I just wasn't paying attention, but I started to enter a four-lane intersection with a medium, so a pretty big intersection, and I hit the curb, and the curb must have been very high because the car, not drivable when I finally got it over to the side of the road. And but thank God I hit the curb, because I think I passed out and I was heading into a major intersection, and I had a pitcher of Bloody Marys I was drinking while that was happening, and then it ended up all over the car. And you know what I did? I got out of the car, got him out, and left it and just walked away. And it sat there for a good week. And boy, was it in bad shape when I picked it up from that tomato juice being in there all week. But that's, that's what I did. I just walked away. I'll deal with it later. I can't handle it. And, that particular night I walked a half a mile or so to my friend's apartment, and with that son with me, and just continued partying. And my mother is as sick as she was with her own stuff, she was not an enabler. And so I didn't have a babysitter built in with her. And I would try. I'd say, would you watch him? I want to go out. But see, I had a reputation in my family of going out and not coming back. And they knew that. And so none of them would watch him for me. And so he went to a lot of places with me. And but thank God he went to a lot of AA meetings with me, too. I think what happened, and all that happened, and plus lots of other stuff in a real short period of time. And, I didn't, the other thing that I didn't mention was the relationships. I was in and out of relationships, and I left that man that I was in love with when I was 18, and never really ended that relationship, and then was in and out of all kinds of relationships. I met guys in jail and we'd start dating. I'm not sure how you do that, but I did that. I just would go out with anybody. I was madly in love, and in 2 weeks I thought, ooh, you need to leave now, And that's just kind of how I did it. And when I got sober, I had, and you know what, this all just came to me about a year ago. And I've been sober a while. I was having affairs with two married men. I was still in a relationship with my son's father, kind of. I had a boyfriend. And that's what I was doing when I got sober. The boyfriend went to jail, and then the other stuff went away because I was getting better. But, you know, I can't imagine now the chaos that that would create in somebody's life. And I don't remember ever thinking it was a big deal. I didn't even know it was happening, quite honestly. I never put that all together. And probably I couldn't, because that is a lot of chaos. But what happened to me was I was living in that apartment. I finally got gas and electric, that apartment that I lived in without it. And I had been there a whole year, and I renewed my lease. And I was very, very proud of that. I had never done that. And I'll tell you, these apartments were the worst apartment complex in town, but I had new carpet and fresh paint, so I thought I was living the high life. And I renewed the lease, and I had been there about a month after I renewed the lease, and I have no idea why they even let me renew the lease, because I had an eviction notice on my door every month. I paid the rent just in the nick of time every month, which was probably like a month behind. And my sister came over one day, and the one that's closest to me in age, and there was all kinds of people there, and we were doing things that she really didn't want to see, and so she kind of left quietly, which is real unlike her. She is not quiet. She's very outspoken, very outgoing, and she just kind of left. She came back the next day, and I was there by just me and my son, and she offered for us to come and live with her, and my immediate reaction was, well, I just signed this lease, I can't leave. Like I care about that. So then she just kind of kept talking and kept saying, well, I'll help you get Billy, put structure in his life. And he was, must have been in first grade then. And she said, well, I'll help you pay the bills. We can get a nice place to live. You can work during the day. And for some reason, I just knew that that was my last chance. That was it. If I didn't take this offer, my family was not there to help me. And so I said, okay. And we moved in together. That was in May. And she had rules for me, and I needed them. And we had we bought groceries together, and we bought a case of wine each week with the groceries, and I was allowed to smoke pot, but only after my son went to sleep. And that boyfriend I had that was in and out of jail, she was not too fond of him, but she did allow him to come over. And he was not allowed to come over if I wasn't there, though. And he was not allowed to move in. He was just allowed to visit. And so that was our rules. And very quickly, I broke all the rules, as you might imagine. And the wine, I would drink the whole case before she even got a chance to open one bottle. So she started taking her half to her boyfriend's house and leaving my half there. And and then I started getting her to babysit for me. And I would do that, not come back all night. And then I had that boyfriend that she didn't like. And things were not going well. I got a job during the day at bartending. And, in Maryland at 5 o'clock, happy hour starts, and that's when my shift ended. And it was very, very hard for me to leave, because my friends would get there about 5, and I'd say, well, I'm just going to have a drink. And the other rules that we had were we shared all the household duties, and it might be my turn to make dinner, and I'm sitting at happy hour, and I don't get home till 9:30 or 10. And she's picking my son up and taking care of him. and that started happening a lot. And I was really feeling guilty about it, and full of remorse, but again, I couldn't do anything different. I just could not do anything different. So, I'm not really sure what happened, but one morning I woke up, I called myself sick into work, got Billy taken to school. That boyfriend that she didn't like was there. The night before, actually, was I had asked her if she'd babysit for me and my girlfriend, our two boys, and she said no, so we took the kids to Washington, D.C. to buy drugs, and came back and left, or came back and then I convinced her to keep them. They were asleep. Oh, I'll put them to bed. They'll be asleep. They won't bother you. We went out to a nightclub, and I was out all night and got home early in the morning. And so that's kind of what happened before. And, you know, not really thinking that I was wanting help, or I didn't really know what to do, but I'll tell you what ended up happening is I overdosed. And she was at work, and my boyfriend called her, and she came home. And that was the moment she had been waiting for, because, see, she already knew about the detox center in the hospital and what you do with how you get somebody in there and all that. And this was her opportunity. And she took it, and she got me to the hospital. And she told me that I had chest pain and that I had to go. And I just said, okay, and off we went. So I ended up in the detox center at the hospital, and it was a 7-day program and voluntary program. And we got there. I didn't know that's where I was going, so I didn't go with any clothes or anything. And when we got there, and they did the intake and the interview and all that stuff, they started to tell me why I was there and what the detox program was. And you know, I was pretty out of it, but I heard you got to stay for 7 days, and I wasn't real fond of that. And that's really all I heard. And my sister, I remember her. I was laying on the table, and she was standing beside me holding my hand, and all she kept saying is, "It's only 7 days, and if you don't like it, you can leave, and I'll take care of Billy for you." And I finally said okay. And I think that was my first spiritual experience. I had the strongest sense of relief that I've ever had in my life that moment. It was like I just let go and said, okay, I'll get help. I'll do something different than what I want to do. And anyway, I went in there and I learned about the disease of alcoholism in that 7 days. And I knew at the end of the 7 days that I was an alcoholic. And I was afraid to leave there at 7 days. And a lot of the people in there were going to go on to a 28-day program, and I called that same sister and said, "I'm afraid to go home. Everybody else is going to a 28 treatment center. Can I go?" And she said, "Yeah, I'll take care of everything. Don't worry about it." And so I got to go. And, you know, I feel real fortunate that I had her to take care of things so I could do that. Because it kept me away, I think, just long enough so that I could learn about the disease of alcoholism and learn what was necessary for my recovery, because that's really what I learned. But I still was very sick, and I'll tell you, the first year, it took me a good year and a half to really start working the program. And, you know, I had trouble with sponsorship. I went to a lot of meetings. You know, there were some things that came real easy to me. Going to meetings came real easy to me. I knew a lot of people. It was a town I grew up in. The first meeting I went to when I was in that detox center outside the detox was a guy that I partied with, and he was celebrating a year. And when I saw that, I thought, my gosh, if he can do that, I can. He drank just like I did. And his mother was giving him his chip and talking about, you know, how much better he was, and they were so hopeful and happy, and his life seemed good, and I just got so much hope from that. But I still had trouble with sponsorship. I went to a lot of meetings, and I did get involved, but it took me a long time to do that fourth step, and it did because I didn't really have a sponsor I was using. And it's a little scary trying to do that by yourself. And, I got involved in the group, got a home group, and I finally, and I was in and out of relationships. That did not change. I stopped dating married men, and I visited the last boyfriend in jail after I'd been about a year sober and walked out of that jail and thought, I will never do this again. I was there on Mother's Day. I was supposed to be home with my mother, and I was in the jail visiting some guy that, you know, was going to be in that jail for the rest of his life, quite honestly. But I had to do it, and I had to experience it sober until I had enough. And I walked out of there and just thought, I'll never come here again. So I kind of was in and out of relationships,
I'd ask people to sponsor me. I wouldn't call them. And finally, I found a woman that had what I wanted. You know, it was just like it all of a sudden made sense to me what you would look for in a sponsor. And and I asked her to be my sponsor, and I started calling her. And then I was able to do that fourth step and able to do that fifth step. And I really feel like, and I probably had about a year, I really feel like that's when I earned my seat here for me, when I did that. And, you know, one thing I didn't mention, when I had about 3 months of sobriety, I came home from work, and I went to work in a retail jewelry store. I made $4.50 an hour, I think. And did not make enough money to pay my bills, but you know what? They got paid. I don't know how. So I came home from work one night, and my sister had said the police came by looking for me. And I found out that night that I had a warrant out for my arrest that I didn't know about, and I had to go to the police station and turn myself in. I was all dressed up from my little job and went down to the police station, and they were being very nice to me because I looked very nice. They were going to just let me sit in this chair and wait for the detective, and you know, I thought, oh, this will be fine, it won't take long, I'll be home, you know, in 30 minutes or so. Well, the detective got there and said, no, she goes in the cell and we are going to arrest her. And turns out that I was under investigation right as before I went into treatment, and I didn't know that. I had been for about 6 months, and they had all kinds of charges on me, and related to selling drugs. And so I sat in that jail cell, and I swear I was fine till they put me in the cell, and I'm not sure what the significance with that was, but I got in there and I thought, now damn it, is this what I got sober for? I don't deserve this. I went to treatment. You know, I don't even use drugs anymore. And I was real mad, really mad. And you know, I didn't have a conscious contact with God yet. I was praying every day, but I had no contact whatsoever. And I was really mad. And but I prayed, because you know what? I didn't think it would work, but that's what you guys had been telling me to do. And I just did it. And the neat thing about all that was, aside from the fact I was arrested, I went through that, was responsible for my actions. long story short, I ended up cocktail waitressing one night a week because I needed to make more money, and the detective came into the bar where I was cocktail waitressing about 6 months or so after after I got arrested, and so I, you know, I guess it was 9 months sober, but anyway, he came in there and sat down, and I thought, oh, shit, I can't wait on him, and so I kind of ignored him, hoping he was just waiting to be called for a table for dinner, because it was a restaurant, and he was stayed, and I went over to the table, and he said hello, and how you doing, all this, introduced me to his partner that was with him, and, you know, like I care. They're undercover, you know, cops. I don't care. I don't want to talk to you. I don't want to be seen talking to you. But anyway, it was really neat. So we talked, and I got them drinks, and they just sat there. So I had to go back. I was hoping they'd okay leave after one. So I had to go back to the table again, talk to them some more. And before he left, he looked at me and he said, "Keep doing what you're doing. You're getting better." And I don't know if that meeting had anything to do with it, but he dropped two of the three charges. And I didn't know that right away. And at the same time, one of those affairs I was having was with my lawyer, so I couldn't call him to help. I could not call him to help. But he did know about it. I must have called him. I think I did call him, but then, you know, he kept asking me out, and I said, forget it. Give me all my stuff. I'll get a public defender. I can't pay you. And so right after that happened, he called and said, you're not going to use a public defender. You'll go to jail. I'll take care of it. You don't owe me anything. And I let him take care of it. And I guess what? I didn't go to jail. So it just kind of showed me that when I'm doing the right thing, good things happen. You know, and I still had to be responsible, and I still had felony charges. I was still convicted of felony charges. I still had probation and all that stuff, and then started having to get a slip signed at meetings, which I didn't like. But, you know, it could have been so much worse than it was. And and that was this program working for me, and it was working for me before I even knew how to work it myself. And so all that was happening. I got that sponsor. I did that fourth and fifth step. And my life was still kind of unmanageable because, you know what, I'm still in and out of relationships like crazy. And I finally decided after a year that I'm going to try that thing that you had suggested a year previous, no relationships for a year, and see if maybe that might help kind of with my sanity. And you know what, it did. And the other thing that I did during that time is I started to get to know women. Because, you know, I was real comfortable with men and not at all comfortable with women. And I wasn't dating anymore, so I started to get to know women. And what a difference that made in my sobriety. I got an opportunity to move to Georgia around the same time. I had switched jobs and went into the healthcare field. And was really happy and doing really well, and the company was closing its office in Annapolis and opening an office in Atlanta, and they offered me a job here, and here. And I moved down here, and I moved here at a time in my sobriety when I wasn't dating and I was trying to get to know women. So I came here with the idea of I don't want, you know, all I want for friends right now are women. And what a neat way to come to a new place and start out, because that's kind of what I did. Is I forced myself to get to know women, and it was hard, and it took me a long time. The other thing that was hard is I left the people I got sober with, and if you've ever done that, you know what I'm talking about. If you haven't, you don't. That is one special group of people. And when you don't leave who you got sober with and you kind of stay there, you don't know how they're changing or it's not real evident. But when you walk out of that group and go back a year later and they're all gone, because they are now, you really know how much, you know, things change here. And anyway, I left that group and I came here and you guys didn't know me the way they knew me. And it was tough. After about 9 months, I finally started telling my sponsor that I got a sponsor here that I'm not doing good and I don't like this and I want to move back. And all along I was saying, I'm fine. And so I started making arrangements to move back and start looking for a job. And one of my sisters was going to share a house with me. And I resigned from my job. And my lease was going to be up after I've been here a year. And we, nothing was working out. I wasn't finding a job. The house we were going to rent wasn't available. And it's getting closer and closer to a time to do something about the lease that's going to expire. And I just kept going back and forth. And my sponsor said to me, you either need to live here or live there. You can't do both. And it just hit me that I got to make a decision. I got to make it now. And nothing's happening there. I'm going to have to stay here. I have a job. They let me keep my job. And I went and found an apartment, and I am very, very grateful for that, because it changed my life, and I don't know what it was about it, but it changed my life. And what happened was, is I really had to work this program, because life wasn't easy for me, and I came close to drinking, and I had to get real serious about my recovery, and everything else worked out. And this became my home. This became my home, and you know, that job, I stayed there for 8 years, and ended up doing very well, and that they went out of business, and I had to look for a job, and guess what, I thought I had a felony conviction on my record, and by this time I'm in a professional position, and you don't get jobs with a record, and so I had finished my probation. They let me transfer it to Georgia and all that stuff. You know, I had done all that. Well, come to find out that the something with the way that I pled, or I don't know, that lawyer that was so nice that took care of me fixed it so that when I finished all of my restitution and probation, that charge was dropped off my record. And I didn't really know that for sure, and I didn't really, you know, I wasn't sure about it, and I had got advice here on it, but anyway, I applied for a job, and I had to fill out the application, and it asked, were you convicted of any felonies? And I really was not sure what to do with that, and I was able to say no because it was off my record, and I got that job. And I'm very grateful for that. In the meantime, I was getting serious about my recovery, as I said, and working the program, getting involved. When I decided to stay here, I went to a fellow in my home group that was the DCM of our district and said, I need to get more involved in AA. I'm scared I'm going to get drunk. I've been sober 3 years, and I hear a lot of people disappear after 3 years. So I want to get more involved. And I said, I've done institution meetings in Maryland, and I'd like to do that. And so he pointed me to somebody, but what this guy did was public information and cooperation with the professional community. And I got involved in that and got involved with service work and spent the next 6 years doing that and have had just a lot of tremendous experiences and met a lot of people. And, you know, one of the things that I am so thankful for as a result of that service work in that capacity and with the state and with Intergroup is it has made my AA world much bigger. And I know so many more people. I have so many friends that I would not have met otherwise, good friends. And, you know, it just kind of made my world just so much broader and being exposed to the state assembly and all that goes on there. And you know, and I love AA, and we've been talking about this a lot. I moved to Albany, and things are a little different there than what I'm used to. And so we've been kind of talking about, you know, AA, and it has reminded me how much I love AA and how much I want it to stay the way it was when I got here. And because I have, that little boy is now 24 years old, and he has two sons of his own, and I have another daughter who's 9, and I have a stepdaughter who's 18, and every one of them have a chance to possibly need this one day. And I want it to be here for them as it was for me. Because you know what? When I came here and I got out of treatment and I got my little meeting scheduled, every meeting I went to was there. The doors were open, coffee was made, there was people there was literature there. And I want that to be the case for my children if they ever need it. And I've just really been thinking about that a lot lately. I also got married, and 13 years ago, and as I said, I have a 9-year-old daughter, and I also had an opportunity to go to college. And you know, I never mentioned that I did quit school with all the stuff that was going on in my life. I quit school in the middle of 12th grade, and that was kind of my pattern before I got here. I quit everything before I finished. I never finished anything. And I started college, I guess I had a couple, 3-4 years sobriety. And I finished in 9 years, and I didn't quit. And I wanted to quit a lot. I can remember talking to my sponsor at least 2 times where I just said, I can't do this. It's going to take too long. I can't do it. It's too hard. And she'd say, one class at a time, you can. And I did. And we got through that, and you know, but in the meantime, I don't get to put AA aside and do that stuff. I do AA and do that stuff, and that's what lets me do that stuff. And you know, I might have had to give up a Friday night meeting so I could study, but that may be it. And and then I had a Friday night meeting for a long time that I could take my daughter to, because there were rooms in the back, and we would go to that meeting just because I could take her, and it didn't have to be a night away from home. So those were the things I had to do when I was trying to go to school and work full time. And I now live in Albany, and I, you know, what brought me there again was a job. That second job I got, I stayed there until they kicked me out. That's what I do with jobs, because I don't like looking for them. And the company was downsizing, and I knew eventually I would be on that list. And so I started looking for a job, and that process brought me to Albany. And I You know, I had moved once in sobriety. I knew what to expect, so that was a little scary for me. I knew I was going to have to move because what I do, there's just not a lot of jobs in any one area. So the likelihood that I'd find one in Atlanta was pretty slim. And so I kind of knew that I was going to have to move. And I started thinking about where I wanted to live and what about AA. I mean, that's always kind of one of the things that I have to consider and you know, my family and that sort of thing. And I interviewed in Nashville for the job in Albany initially and learned about the hospital. I work in healthcare and thought, you know, I'd really like to go meet the people and talk to them. It sounds like a really nice place. And so I went there, and I had been to Albany once in my life, and it was for the prepaid convention, and it was right after that Albany had a bad flood, and I thought it was the most horrible place in the world. And really, it was where we were. That was my only experience with Albany. But when I talked to them about it, and I kind of told them without saying I was at an AA convention, my experience with Albany, and they're like, oh, I promise you, there's another side of the tracks. It's not all like that. And I got there, and they were right. It wasn't all like that. I was very impressed with the hospital. And I was most impressed with the community. I just thought, this is really nice. I've got this 9-year-old daughter, and this is a great place for her, and I'm really tired of the Atlanta traffic. And I knew the DCM in Albany from the assembly. And, you know, so we started the process of interviewing with the hospital and eventually took the job and started moving there. And, you know, here I am again. Going to meetings, and you know, I was told when I moved from Maryland to Georgia that when I move, although I've been sober a year and a half, and to me that was a very long time, that I was a newcomer when I got there, and I had to do what newcomers did, and I did. When I got to Georgia, I went to 90 meetings in 90 days and got a sponsor. I was not reaching out as much as I should have, and that got me in trouble, but That suggestion and that experience helped me to know that when I moved to Albany, I needed to do the same thing. But what I knew I needed to do that I didn't do the first time was to reach out and to tell people this is hard for me. And you know, the other thing I had to do was get another sponsor. And I've had my sponsor for 16 years, and I didn't want to do that. And someone made the suggestion to me. I left town for 8 years. I had to get another sponsor. I was still able to keep my one here, but you need somebody that you can be face-to-face accountable to. So I said, okay, you know. And I did what she suggested. And I'll tell you, it's not been easy. I've been there about 10 months. And but what has happened is I am reaching out. I am getting involved, even when it's not comfortable. I did get that sponsor. That relationship is developing, but it's hard for me to get to know someone else. And I have gotten involved in my home group. And the neat thing is, I never thought I would find a group that I was as comfortable in as I was with my one here, but I am finding that there. That group is becoming the best home group in the state of Georgia, as the one I was in here was. And and I know that it will be as I get more comfortable there. And you know, it's working out, and it's a lot better this time than it was the last time that I moved. And the other thing that has happened when I got to when I moved to Albany after being there a few months, my marriage, my husband and I decided to separate. And that was really hard for me, and because I had been sober here a long time, sponsored a lot of women that were married that said, I want you to be my sponsor because you have a good marriage. You know, I got married to stay married and not get divorced. I don't do those things now. I'm sober. And, you know, and here I was separated and getting divorced. And I really had a hard time with that, really had a hard time with the guilt, really had a hard time with what's God's will and should I be doing this, should I be just sticking it out, you know. And but I did, again, what you told me to do, and I've been reaching out, and And, you know, the blessing in all this is my husband is also a recovering alcoholic that works this program, and we've worked together on it. And we have worked together on making it as easy as we can for our daughter, and we're not fighting, and she's not exposed to any fighting or hostility, and we're sharing the responsibility of her, and she feels loved. And, you know, I would not be able to tell you that if I wasn't a sober member of AA. I ended relationships in the past with a lot of screaming and yelling and throwing things, slamming doors, speeding away in cars, you know, just all that kind of turmoil, and that's just not what's happening. And going back many times to fight more, and we're not doing that. We are, and not to say that each one of us don't have our own anger and all that other stuff, but we don't have to expose our daughter to that. And we both have sponsors that we can talk to, and we've gotten outside help to help us work it out. You know, I just, as bad as the situation is, I feel very grateful because it has been a lot easier than it could have been. And, you know, and little by little, you're helping me get through my issues of guilt and I shouldn't be doing this and, you know, I'm too sober to be getting divorced. And I know people get divorced in sobriety. And you know, it happens all the time, but not to me. And you know, I've had to do a lot of seeking myself, trying to figure out, is this God's will for me? Is it okay? You know, all that stuff. And am I going to get drunk? And because I have to tell you, no matter what's happening, my sobriety is my top priority, and it has to be. And I know it has to be because you've been telling me that as long as I've been coming here. And, I'm very grateful because when I take care of that, everything else works out. It all works out, and you know we're working through it, and I'm going to a lot of meetings, and I'm talking to a lot of people, and I'm keeping that little girl close to me. As horrible as it is, I just feel very grateful because I have this way to do it, and because I wouldn't want to do to her what I did to my son. And, you know, the miracle is he is a wonderful young man, just wonderful. I don't know how he got that way. I do not know how he got that way. And he has two children. He's very responsible. I'm a grandmother. And, you know, and he respects me. And I don't know why. Except because of AA. I mean, that's the only reason why. And, you know, I kind of look at my life today and I think, my gosh, if I was drinking, I wouldn't fit in it. It just wouldn't work. You know, when I was drinking out in bars, I'm dancing on the bar and falling off and starting fights and driving into cement walls. And, that just wouldn't work in my life. I wouldn't have my job. You know, the children I had, my daughter wouldn't put up with that like my son did. she would not put up with that. I wouldn't have the people in my life that I can call at any time for anything. I would have already used you all up. The neat thing is, and I brought some of my good friends from Albany with me. I already have friends in Albany that I can call anytime for anything. And I've been there less than a year. And that's just incredible to me. They're my sober friends from AA. And that's what we do for each other. And I told Charles that I wouldn't talk too long so he wouldn't have to use two tapes. So I will end and just say that I'm grateful to be here, and it's so good to be here in this room with you guys tonight, and I miss being here. And I'm so grateful to be sober. And, if you're new, just know that the miracle happens. And Jennifer told me my only job it was to explain to you that a miracle will happen. And it has happened for me, and I didn't get from the person I was to who I am today on my own. It was God, and it was a miracle, and AA, and I'm real grateful for that. Thank you very much.